and leapt to his feet as I pulled up at the gate. He emerged from his cabin and approached my window. "Do you know where you're going?" "Yes," I lied. "Who are you here with?" That was a trickier one, but I dealt with it. "Okay, just follow the one-way system around." I drove into a vast expanse of clear skies, grass, concrete and airfield. The path ahead led to an old DC-3 passenger plane. I followed the broken concrete track to the right. An office building stood amongst a haphazard collection of large green metal warehouses. I dropped down a ramp into a staging area in front of a much larger hangar. At the far end of it, on the edge of the airfield, lay a very dilapidated cabin with "production" daubed on its side. A Harrier jump jet was parked in the middle distance. It seemed I'd arrived at the studio. With a little time in hand, I walked the site. The airfield was as flat as a billiard table, with neat green fields surrounding the tarmac landing strips. I couldn't make out any kind of circuit in the sea of grey mist. A tired silver tree line separated the earth from the clear blue sky. The place must have had a real buzz in its glory days, first during the Second World War and then as a Harrier proving ground. On this still morning, I could almost hear the banter of aircrew scrambling to their aircraft. Now it felt like the land that time forgot. Rusted control panels littered the area. Cracked concrete billets jostled with disused hangars and pebble-dashed 70s monstrosities. I paid an obligatory pre-match visit to the nearby loos. Two fresh pieces of graffiti read, "Fuck Jeremy Clarkson and Richard Hammond is a..." Sadly, Hammond's eulogy had never been completed. My laughter echoed down the deserted corridor and I felt like a madman. I returned to the production hut and gave it the once-over. A cardboard cutout of a policeman stood guard at the window beside a larger cutout still of John Prescott, an ironing board, a moth-eaten mini-sofa and a cluster of toxic coffee cups and Bic biros. What the hell did they do here? A worn chair overlooked a grubby telephone which sat, inert, on a filthy wood-veneered table. A printed list of key contacts was pinned to the wall, belying the cabin's absence of discernible function. Room 2 was marginally better appointed, with a small TV set surrounded by VHS tapes, but no player. A few photos of random celebrities decorated the flimsy, cobwebbed walls. Room 3 contained a large hanging rail from which hung a gold sequin jacket, a flower power shirt, and an enormous pair of jeans. A crate of Red Bull lurked in the corner. The place stank of fags, mildew, and eau de man. With an uncertain recollection of my last tetanus jab, I opted to wait inside my car and nod off to some filthy hard house tunes. I woke to the sound of rushing gravel as a small hatchback pulled up in front of me. I guess this was my man by his silver hair and media-issue denim jacket. I climbed out to greet him. He hitched up his trousers and shuffled towards me like a glum but familiar uncle on a rare visit home. It was only 9:30, but his 5 o'clock shadow suggested he had already had a long day. He clasped a bursting folder of papers under one arm. He looked in every direction but mine. I moved to shake his hand. With some reluctance, he eventually reciprocated. "Right. Great to meet you, Andy. Did you tell anyone you were coming?" he asked. "No," I said. "Okay, good." Andy explained that the track would be open for some fast laps at 10. I had no idea of what the track even looked like, what car I would be driving, or what test lay ahead, so it wasn't easy to prepare for what came next. Andy unlocked a blue Ford Focus in the car park, and it dawned on me that this underpowered, front-wheel drive affair would be his measuring stick of my performance. Years of racing in Formula One-style machines went out the window. It was time to rely on a few bad habits. Andy hunched over the wheel and drove us serenely around the track. But for the occasional steely-eyed glare at a corner, his eyes sparkled as if he was enjoying some private joke. The silver fox indicated the areas I was not allowed to drive across, such as the white lines on the exit of the first corner, coming out of the second corner, and especially those marking the hammerhead chicane. I nodded respectfully, as you do on the headmaster's tour of the school grounds. The track looked straightforward enough, and there were some ballsy fast corners in the middle that could be hairy in a proper car. "This one sorts out the men from the boys," Andy said with something approaching relish. A riot of skid marks and freshly carved up grass around the final corners did indeed suggest that the last two turns might be treacherous. Andy's expression darkened again as he parked on the start line and he